Side 9. The City and the Stars and the Sands of Mars by Arthur C. Clarke. Continuing with The Sands of Mars on page 346.
I'm mighty glad they didn't, grinned Norden. That would have taken some explaining away.
Jimmy Spencer, who as usual got the job that no one else wanted to do, found the puncture 3 days later, after only a dozen circuits of the ship. The blurred little crater was scarcely visible to the eye, but the supersensitive leak detector had registered the fact that the vacuum near this part of the hull was not as perfect as it should have been. Jimmy had marked the place with chalk and gone thankfully back into the airlock. Norden dug out the ship's plans and located the approximate position from Jimmy's report. Then he whistled softly, and his eyebrows climbed towards the ceiling.
Jimmy, he said, does Mr. Gibson know what you've been up to?
No, said Jimmy. I've not missed giving him his astronautics class, though it's been quite a job to manage it as well as...
All right, all right. You don't think anyone else would have told him about the leak?
I don't know, but I think he'd have mentioned it if they had.
Well, listen carefully. This blasted puncture is smack in the middle of his cabin wall, and if you breathe a word about it to him, I'll skin you. Understand?
Yes, gulped Jimmy, and fled precipitately.
Now what? Said Hilton in tones of resignation.
We've got to get Martin out of the way on some pretext, and plug the hole as quickly as we can.
It's funny he never noticed the impact. It would have made quite a din. He was probably out at the time. I'm surprised he never noticed the air current. It must be fairly considerable. Probably masked by the normal circulation. But anyway, why all the fuss?
Why not come clean about it and explain what's happened to Martin?
There's no need for all this melodrama.
Oh, isn't there? Suppose Martin tells his public that a 12th magnitude meteor has holed the ship, and then goes on to say that this sort of thing happens every other voyage. How many of his readers will understand not only that it's no real danger, but that we don't usually bother to do anything even when it does happen? I'll tell you what the popular reaction would be. If it was a little one, it might just as well be a big un. The public's never trusted statistics. And can't you see the headlines? Ares holed by meteor? That would be bad for trade.
Then why not simply tell Martin and ask him to keep quiet?
It wouldn't be fair on the poor chap. He's had no news to hang his articles onto for weeks. It would be kinder to say nothing.
Okay, sighed Hilton. It's your idea. Don't blame me if it backfires.
It won't. I think I've got a watertight plan.
I don't give a damn if it's watertight. Is it airtight?
All his life, Gibson had been fascinated by gadgets, and the spacesuit was yet another to add to the collection of mechanisms he had investigated and mastered. Bradley had been detailed to make sure that he understood the drill correctly, to take him out into space, and to see that he didn't get lost. Gibson had forgotten that the suits on the Ares had no legs, and that one simply sat inside them. That was sensible enough, since they were built for use under zero gravity, and not for walking on airless planets. The absence of flexible leg joints greatly simplified the designs of the suits, which were nothing more than perspex-topped cylinders sprouting articulated arms at their upper ends. Along the sides were mysterious flutings and bulges concerned with the air conditioning, radio, heat regulators, and the low-powered propulsion system. There was considerable freedom of movement inside them. One could withdraw one's arms to get at the internal controls, and even take a meal without too many acrobatics. Bradley had spent almost an hour in the airlock, making certain that Gibson understood all the main controls and catechizing him on their operation. Gibson appreciated his thoroughness, but began to get a little impatient when the lesson showed no sign of ending. He eventually mutinied when Bradley started to explain the suit's primitive sanitary arrangements.
Hang it all, he protested. We aren't going to be outside that long.
Bradley grinned.
You'd be surprised, he said darkly. Just how many people make that mistake.
He opened a compartment in the airlock wall and took out two spools of line, for all the world like fishermen's reels. They locked firmly into the mountings on the suits, so that they could not be accidentally dislodged.
Number one safety precaution, he said. Always have a lifeline anchoring you to the ship. Rules are made to be broken, but not this one. To make doubly sure, I'll tie your suit to mine with another 10 meters of cord. Now we're ready to ascend the Matterhorn.
The outer door slid aside. Gibson felt the last trace of air tugging at him as it escaped. The feeble impulse set him moving towards the exit, and he drifted slowly out into the stars. The slowness of motion and the utter silence combined to make the moment deeply impressive. The Ares was receding behind him with a terrible inevitability. He was plunging into space, at last, his only link with safety that tenuous thread unreeling at his side. Yet the experience, though so novel, awoke faint echoes of familiarity in his mind. His brain must have been working with unusual swiftness, for he recalled the parallel almost immediately. This was like the moment in his childhood, a moment he could have sworn until now forgotten beyond recall, when he had been taught to swim by being dropped into 10 meters of water. Once again he was plunging headlong into a new and unknown element. The friction of the reel had checked his momentum when the cord attaching him to Bradley gave a jerk. He had almost forgotten his companion, who was now blasting away from the ship with the little gas jets at the base of his suit, towing Gibson behind him. Gibson was quite startled when the other's voice, echoing metallically from the speaker in his suit, shattered the silence.
Don't use your jets unless I tell you. We don't want to build up too much speed, and we must be careful not to get our lines tangled.
All right, said Gibson, vaguely annoyed at the intrusion into his privacy. He looked back at the ship. It was already several hundred meters away, and shrinking rapidly.
How much line have we got?
He asked anxiously. There was no reply, and he had a moment of mild panic before remembering to press the transmit switch.
About a kilometer,
Bradley answered when he repeated the question.
That's enough to make one feel nice and lonely.
Suppose it broke? Asked Gibson, only half joking.
It won't. It could support your full weight back on Earth. Even if it did, we could get back perfectly easily with our jets.
And if they ran out?
This is a very cheerful conversation. I can't imagine that happening, except through gross carelessness, or about 3 simultaneous mechanical failures. Remember, there's a spare propulsion unit for just such emergencies. And you've got warning indicators in the suit, which let you know well before the main tank's empty.
But just supposing, insisted Gibson.
In that case, the only thing to do would be to switch on the suit's SOS beacon and wait until someone came out to haul you back. I doubt if they'd hurry in such circumstances. Anyone who got himself in a mess like that wouldn't receive much sympathy.
There was a sudden jerk. They had come to the end of the line. Bradley killed the rebound with his jets.
We're a long way from home now, he said quietly.
It took Gibson several seconds to locate the Ares. They were on the night side of the ship, so that it was almost wholly in shadow. The two spheres were thin, distant crescents that might easily have been taken for Earth and Moon, seen from perhaps 1 million kilometers away. There was no real sense of contact. The ship was too small and frail a thing to be regarded as a sanctuary anymore. Gibson was alone with the stars at last. He was always grateful that Bradley left him in silence and did not intrude upon his thoughts. Perhaps the other was equally overwhelmed by the splendid solemnity of the moment. The stars were so brilliant and so numerous that at first Gibson could not locate even the most familiar constellations. Then he found Mars the brightest object in the sky next to the sun itself, and so determined the plane of the ecliptic. Very gently, with cautious bursts from his gas jets, he swung the suit round so that his head pointed roughly towards the pole star. He was the right way up again, and the star patterns were recognizable once more.
Slowly he made his way along the Zodiac, wondering how many other men in history had so far shared this experience. Soon, of course, it would be common enough, and the magic would be dimmed by familiarity. Presently he found Jupiter and later Saturn, or so he imagined. The planets could no longer be distinguished from the stars by the steady, unwinking light that was such a useful, though sometimes treacherous, guide to amateur astronomers. Gibson did not search for Earth or Venus, for the glare of the sun would have dazzled him in a moment if he had turned his eyes in that direction. A pale band of light, welding the two hemispheres of the sky together, the whole ring of the Milky Way was visible. Gibson could see quite clearly the vents and tears along its edge, where entire continents of stars seemed trying to break away and go voyaging alone into the abyss. In the southern hemisphere, the black chasm of the coal sack gaped like a tunnel drilled through the stars into another universe. The thought made Gibson turn towards Andromeda. There lay the great nebula, a ghostly lens of light. He could cover it with his thumbnail, yet it was a whole galaxy as vast as the sky-spanning ring of stars in whose heart he was floating now. That misty specter was a million times farther away than the stars, and they were a million times more distant than the planets. How pitiful were all men's voyagings and adventures when seen against this background! Gibson was looking for Alpha Centauri, among the unknown constellations of the southern hemisphere, when he caught sight of something which, for a moment, his mind failed to identify. At an immense distance, a white rectangular object was floating against the stars. That, at least, was Gibson's first impression. Then he realized that his sense of perspective was at fault and that, in fact, he was really seeing something quite small, only a few meters away. Even then it was some time before he recognized this interplanetary wanderer for what it was. A perfectly ordinary sheet of quarto manuscript paper, very slowly revolving in space. Nothing could have been more commonplace or more unexpected here. Gibson stared at the apparition for some time before he convinced himself that it was no illusion. Then he switched on his transmitter and spoke to Bradley. The other was not in the least surprised. "There's nothing very remarkable about that," he replied rather impatiently. "We've been throwing out waste every day for weeks, and as we haven't any acceleration, some of it may still be hanging round. As soon as we start breaking, of course, we'll drop back from it, and all our junk will go shooting out of the solar system." How perfectly obvious, thought Gibson, feeling a little foolish, for nothing is more disconcerting than a mystery which suddenly evaporates. It was probably a rough draft of one of his own articles. If it had been a little closer, it would be amusing to retrieve it as a souvenir and to see what effects its stay in space had produced. Unfortunately, it was just out of reach, and there was no way of capturing it without slipping the cord that linked him with the Ares. When he had been dead for ages, that piece of paper would still be carrying its message out among the stars. And what it was, he would never know. Norden met them when they returned to the airlock. He seemed rather pleased with himself, though Gibson was in no condition to notice such details. He was still lost among the stars, and it would be some time before he returned to normal, before his typewriter began to patter softly as he tried to recapture his emotions. "You managed the job in time?" asked Bradley when Gibson was out of hearing. "Yes, with 15 minutes to spare. We shut off the ventilators and found the leak right away with the good old smoky candle technique. A blind rivet and a spot of quick-drying paint did the rest. We can plug the outer hull when we're in dock if it's worth it. Mac did a pretty neat job. He's wasting his talents as a navigator." Chapter 6. For Martin Gibson, the voyage was running smoothly and pleasantly enough. As he always did, he had now managed to organize his surroundings, by which he meant not only his material environment, but also the human beings who shared it with him, to his maximum comfort. He had done a satisfactory amount of writing, some of it quite good and most of it passable, though he would not get properly into his stride until he had reached Mars. The flight was now entering upon its closing weeks, and there was an inevitable sense of anticlimax and slackening interest, which would last until they entered the orbit of Mars. Nothing would happen until then. For the time being, all of the excitements of the voyage were over. The last highlight for Gibson had been the morning when he finally lost the Earth. Day by day it had come closer to the vast pearly wings of the corona, as though about to immolate all its millions in the funeral pyre of the sun. One evening it had still been visible through the telescope, a tiny spark glittering bravely against the splendor that was soon to overwhelm it. Gibson had thought it might still be visible in the morning, but overnight some colossal explosion had thrown the corona 500,000 kilometers farther into space, and Earth was lost against that incandescent curtain. It would be a week before it reappeared, and by then Gibson's world would have changed more than he would have believed possible in so short a time. If anyone had asked Jimmy Spencer just what he thought of Gibson, that young man would have given rather different replies at various stages of the voyage. At first, he had been quite overawed by his distinguished shipmate, but that stage had worn off very quickly. To do Gibson credit, he was completely free from snobbery, and he never made unreasonable use of his privileged position on board the Ares. Thus, from Jimmy's point of view, he was more approachable than the rest of the liner's inhabitants, all of whom were in some degree his superior officers. When Gibson had started taking a serious interest in astronautics, Jimmy had seen him at close quarters once or twice a week, and had made several efforts to weigh him up. This had not been at all easy, for Gibson never seemed to be the same person for very long. There were times when he was considerate and thoughtful, and generally good company. Yet there were other occasions when he was so grumpy and morose that he easily qualified as the person on the Ares most to be avoided. What Gibson thought of him, Jimmy wasn't at all sure. He sometimes had an uncomfortable feeling that the author regarded him purely as raw material that might or might not be of value some day. Most people who knew Gibson slightly had that impression, and most of them were right. Yet as he had tried to pump Jimmy directly, there seemed no real grounds for these suspicions. Another puzzling thing about Gibson was his technical background. When Jimmy had started his evening classes, as everyone called them, he had assumed that Gibson was merely anxious to avoid glaring errors in the material he radioed back to Earth, and had no very deep interest in astronautics for its own sake. It soon became clear that this was far from being the case. Gibson had an almost pathetic anxiety to master quite abstruse branches of the science, and to demand mathematical proofs, some of which Jimmy was hard put to provide. The older man must once have had a good deal of technical knowledge, fragments of which still remained with him. How he had acquired it, he never explained, nor did he give any reason for his almost obsessive attempts, doomed though they were to repeated failures, to come to grips with scientific ideas far too advanced for him. Gibson's disappointment after these failures was so obvious that Jimmy found himself very sorry for him, except on those occasions when his pupil became bad-tempered and showed a tendency to blame his instructor. Then there would be a brief exchange of discourtesies. Jimmy would pack up his books and the lesson would not be resumed until Gibson had apologized. Sometimes, on the other hand, Gibson took these setbacks with humorous resignation and simply changed the subject. He would then talk about his experiences in the strange literary jungle in which he lived, a world of weird and often carnivorous beasts whose behavior Jimmy found quite fascinating. Gibson was a good raconteur, with a fine flair for purveying scandal and undermining reputations. He seemed to do this without any malice, and some of the stories he told Jimmy about the distinguished figures of the day quite shocked that somewhat straight-laced youth. The curious fact was that the people whom Gibson so readily dissected often seemed to be his closest friends. This was something that Jimmy found very hard to understand. Yet despite all these warnings, Jimmy talked readily enough when the time came. One of their lessons had grounded on a reef of integro-differential equations, and there was nothing to do but abandon ship. Gibson was in one of his amiable moods, and as he closed his books with a sigh, he turned to Jimmy and remarked casually,
"You've never told me anything about yourself, Jimmy. What part of England do you come from, anyway?"
"Cambridge. At least, that's where I was born. I used to know it quite well, 20 years ago.
But you don't live there now?"
"No. When I was about 6, my people moved to Leeds. I've been there ever since."
"What made you take up astronautics?"
"It's rather hard to say. I was always interested in science, and of course spaceflight was the coming thing when I was growing up. So I suppose it was just natural. If I'd been born 50 years before, I guess I'd have gone into aeronautics."
"So you're interested in spaceflight purely as a technical problem and not as, shall we say, something that might revolutionize human thought, open up new planets and all that sort of thing?"
Jimmy grinned. "I suppose that's true enough. Of course I am interested in these ideas, but it's the technical side that really fascinates me. Even if there was nothing on the planets, I'd still want to know how to reach them."
Gibson shook his head in mock distress.
"You're going to grow up into one of those cold-blooded scientists who know everything about nothing. Another good man wasted."
"I'm glad you think it will be a waste," said Jimmy with some spirit. "Anyway, why are you so interested in science?"
Gibson laughed, but there was a trace of annoyance in his voice as he replied,
"I'm only interested in science as a means, not as an end in itself."
That, Jimmy was sure, was quite untrue. But something warned him not to pursue the matter any further, and before he could reply, Gibson was questioning him again. It was all done in such a friendly spirit of apparently genuine interest that Jimmy couldn't avoid feeling flattered, couldn't help talking freely and easily. Somehow, it didn't matter if Gibson was indeed studying him as disinterestedly and as clinically as a biologist watching the reactions of one of his laboratory animals. Jimmy felt like talking, and he preferred to give Gibson's motives the benefit of the doubt. He talked of his childhood and early life, and presently Gibson understood the occasional clouds that sometimes seemed to overlie the lad's normally cheerful disposition. It was an old story, one of the oldest. Jimmy's mother had died when he was a little more than a baby, and his father had left him in the charge of a married sister. Jimmy's aunt had been kind to him, but he had never felt at home among his cousins, had always been an outsider. Nor had his father been a great deal of help, for he was seldom in England, and had died when Jimmy was about 10 years old. He appeared to have left very little impression on his son, who, strangely enough, seemed to have clearer memories of the mother whom he could scarcely have known. Once the barriers were down, Jimmy talked without reticence, as if glad to unburden his mind. Sometimes Gibson asked questions to prompt him, but the questions grew further and further apart, and presently came no more.
"I don't think my parents were really very much in love," said Jimmy.
"From what Aunt Ellen told me, it was all rather a mistake. There was another man first, but that fell through. My father was the next best thing. Oh, I know this sounds rather heartless, but please remember it all happened such a long time ago, and doesn't mean much to me now."
"I understand," said Gibson quietly, and it seemed as if he really did.
"Tell me more about your mother."
"Her father, my granddad, that is, was one of the professors at the university. I think mother spent all her life in Cambridge. When she was old enough, she went to college for her degree. She was studying history."
"Oh, all this can't possibly interest you."
"It really does," said Gibson earnestly. "Go on."
So Jimmy talked. Everything he told must have been learned from hearsay, but the picture he gave Gibson was surprisingly clear and detailed. His listener guessed that Aunt Ellen must have been very talkative, and Jimmy a very attentive small boy. It was one of those innumerable college romances that briefly flower and wither during that handful of years which seems a microcosm of life itself. But this one had been more serious than most. During her last term, Jimmy's mother, he still hadn't told Gibson her name, had fallen in love with a young engineering student who was halfway through his college career. It had been a whirlwind romance, and the match was an ideal one, despite the fact that the girl was several years older than the boy. Indeed, it had almost reached the stage of an engagement when... Jimmy wasn't quite sure what had happened. The young man had been taken seriously ill, or had had a nervous breakdown, and had never come back to Cambridge. "My mother never really got over it," said Jimmy with a grave assumption of wisdom, which somehow did not seem completely incongruous. "But another student was very much in love with her, and so she married him. I sometimes feel rather sorry for my father, for he must have known all about the other affair. I never say much of him because... Why, Mr. Gibson, don't you feel well?" Gibson forced a smile. "It's nothing. Just a touch of space sickness. I get it now and then. It will pass in a minute." He only wished that the words were true. All these weeks, in total ignorance and believing himself secure against all the shocks of time and chance, he had been steering a collision course with fate. And now the moment of impact had come. The 20 years that lay behind had vanished like a dream, and he was face to face once more with the ghosts of his own forgotten past. "There's something wrong with Martin," said Bradley, signing the signals log with a flourish. "It can't be any news he's had from Earth. I've read it all. Do you suppose he's getting homesick?"
"He's left it a little late in the day, if that's the explanation," replied Norden. "After all, we'll be on Mars in a fortnight. But you do rather fancy yourself as an amateur psychologist, don't you?"
"Well, who doesn't?"
"I don't, for one," began Norden pontifically. "Prying into other people's affairs isn't one of my..."
An anticipatory gleam in Bradley's eyes warned him just in time. And to the other's evident disappointment, he checked himself in mid-sentence. Martin Gibson, complete with notebook and looking like a cub reporter attending his first press conference, had hurried into the office.
"Well, Owen, what was it you wanted to show me?" he asked eagerly.
Bradley moved to the main communication rack.
"It isn't really very impressive," he said, "but it means that we've passed another milestone, and always gives me a bit of a kick. Listen to this."
He pressed the speaker switch and slowly brought up the volume control. The room was flooded with the hiss and crackle of radio noise, like the sound of 1,000 frying pans at the point of imminent ignition. It was a sound that Gibson had heard often enough in the signals cabin, and, for all its unvarying monotony, it never failed to fill him with a sense of wonder. He was listening, he knew, to the voices of the stars and nebulae, to radiations that had set out upon their journey before the birth of man. And buried far down in the depths of that crackling, whispering chaos, there might be, there must be, the sounds of alien civilizations talking to one another in the deeps of space. But, alas, their voices were lost beyond recall in the welter of cosmic interference which nature herself had made. This, however, was certainly not what Bradley had called him to hear. Very delicately, the signals officer made some vernier adjustments, frowning a little as he did so.
"I had it on the nose a minute ago. Hope it hasn't drifted off. Ah, here it is."
At first, Gibson could detect no alteration in the barrage of noise. Then he noticed that Bradley was silently marking time with his hand, rather quickly, at the rate of some 2 beats every second. With this to guide him, Gibson presently detected the infinitely faint undulating whistle that was breaking through the cosmic storm.
"What is it?"
he asked, already half-guessing the answer.
"It's the radio beacon on Deimos. There's one on Phobos as well, but it's not so powerful and we can't pick it up yet. When we get nearer Mars, we'll be able to fix ourselves within a few 100 kilometers by using them. We're at 10 times the usable range now, but it's nice to know."
Yes, thought Gibson, it is nice to know. Of course, these radio aids weren't essential when one could see one's destination all the time, but they simplified some of the navigational problems. As he listened with half-closed eyes to that faint pulsing, sometimes almost drowned by the cosmic barrage, he knew how the mariners of old must have felt when they caught the first glimpse of the harbour lights from far out at sea.
"I think that's enough," said Bradley, switching off the speaker and restoring silence.
Anyway, it should give you something new to write about. Things have been pretty quiet lately, haven't they?
He was watching Gibson intently as he said this, but the author never responded. He merely jotted a few words in his notebook, thanked Bradley with absent-minded and unaccustomed politeness, and departed to his cabin.
You're quite right, said Norden when he had gone. Something certainly happened to Martin. I'd better have a word with Doc.
I shouldn't bother, replied Bradley.
Whatever it is, I don't think it's anything you can handle with pills. Better leave Martin to work it out his own way.
Maybe you're right, said Norden grudgingly.
But I hope he doesn't take too long over it.
He had now taken almost a week. The initial shock of discovering that Jimmy Spencer was Kathleen Morgan's son had already worn off, but the secondary effects were beginning to make themselves felt. Among these was a feeling of resentment that anything like this should have happened to him. It was such an outrageous violation of the laws of probability, the sort of thing that would never have happened in one of Gibson's own novels. But life was so inartistic, and there was really nothing one could do about it. This mood of childish petulance was now passing, to be replaced by a deeper sense of discomfort. All the emotions he had thought safely buried beneath 20 years of feverish activity were now rising to the surface again, like deep-sea creatures slain in some submarine eruption. On Earth, he could have escaped by losing himself once more in the crowd, but here he was trapped, with nowhere to flee. It was useless to pretend that nothing had really changed, to say, "Of course I knew that Kathleen and Gerald had a son. What difference does that make now?" It made a great deal of difference. Every time he saw Jimmy, he would be reminded of the past and, what was worse, of the future that might have been. The most urgent problem now was to face the facts squarely and to come to grips with the new situation. Gibson knew well enough that there was only one way in which this could be done, and the opportunity would arise soon enough. Jimmy had been down to the southern hemisphere and was making his way along the equatorial observation deck when he saw Gibson sitting at one of the windows, staring out into space. For a moment he thought the other had not seen him and had decided not to intrude upon his thoughts when Gibson called out,
"Hello, Jimmy. Have you got a moment to spare?"
As it happened, Jimmy was rather busy. But he knew that there had been something wrong with Gibson, and realized that the older man needed his presence. So he came and sat on the bench recessed into the observation port, and presently he knew as much of the truth as Gibson thought good for either of them.
"I'm going to tell you something, Jimmy," Gibson began, "which is known to only a handful of people. Don't interrupt me and don't ask any questions, not until I've finished at any rate. When I was rather younger than you, I wanted to be an engineer. I was quite a bright kid in those days, and had no difficulty in getting into college through the usual examinations. As I wasn't sure what I intended to do, I took the 5-year course in general engineering physics, which was quite a new thing in those days. In my first year, I did fairly well, well enough to encourage me to work harder next time. In my second year, I did, not brilliantly, but a lot better than average. And in the third year, I fell in love. It wasn't exactly for the first time, but I knew it was the real thing at last. Now, falling in love while you're at college may or may not be a good thing for you. It all depends on the circumstances. If it's only a mild flirtation, it probably doesn't matter one way or the other. But if it's really serious, there are two possibilities. It may act as a stimulus. It may make you determined to do your best, to show that you're better than the other fellows. On the other hand, you may get so emotionally involved in the affair that nothing else seems to matter, and your studies go to pieces. That is what happened in my case."
Gibson fell into a brooding silence, and Jimmy stole a glance at him as he sat in the darkness a few feet away. They were on the night side of the ship, and the corridor lights had been dimmed so that the stars could be seen in their unchallenged glory. The constellation of Leo was directly ahead, and there, in its heart, was the brilliant ruby gem that was their goal. Next to the sun itself, Mars was by far the brightest of all celestial bodies, and already its disk was just visible to the naked eye. The brilliant crimson light, playing full on his face, gave Gibson a healthy, even a cheerful appearance quite out of keeping with his feelings. Was it true, Gibson wondered, that one never really forgot anything? It seemed now as if it might be. He could still see, as clearly as he had 20 years ago, that message pinned on the faculty notice board. The Dean of Engineering wishes to see M. Gibson in his office at 3. He had had to wait, of course, until 3:15, and that hadn't helped. Nor would it have been so bad if the Dean had been sarcastic or icily aloof, or even if he had lost his temper. Gibson could still picture that inhumanly tidy room, with its neat files and careful rows of books, could remember the Dean's secretary padding away on her typewriter in the corner, pretending not to listen. Perhaps, now he came to think of it, she wasn't pretending after all. The experience wouldn't have been so novel to her as it was to him. Gibson had liked and respected the Dean for all the old man's finicky ways and meticulous pedantry, and now he had let him down, which made his failure doubly hard to bear. The Dean had rubbed it in with his more in sorrow than in anger technique, which had been more effective than he knew or intended. He had given Gibson another chance, but he was never to take it. What made matters worse, though he was ashamed to admit the fact, was that Kathleen had done fairly well in her own exams. When his results had been published, Gibson had avoided her for several days, and when they met again, he had already identified her with the cause of his failure. He could see this so clearly now that it no longer hurt. Had he really been in love if he was prepared to sacrifice Kathleen for the sake of his own self-respect? For that is what it came to. He had tried to shift the blame onto her. The rest was inevitable. That quarrel on their last long cycle ride together into the country, and their returns by separate routes. The letters that hadn't been opened. Above all, the letters that hadn't been written. Their unsuccessful attempt to meet, if only to say goodbye, on his last day in Cambridge. But even this had fallen through. The message hadn't reached Kathleen in time, and though he had waited until the last minute, she had never come. The crowded train, packed with cheering students, had drawn noisily out of the station, leaving Cambridge and Kathleen behind. He had never seen either again. There was no need to tell Jimmy about the dark months that had followed. He need never know what was meant by the simple words, "I had a breakdown and was advised not to return to college." Dr. Evans had made a pretty good job of patching him up, and he'd always be grateful for that. It was Evans who'd persuaded him to take up writing during his convalescence, with results that had surprised them both. How many people knew that his first novel had been dedicated to his psychoanalyst? Well, if Rachmaninoff could do the same thing with the C minor concerto, why shouldn't he? Evans had given him a new personality and a vocation through which he could win back his self-confidence. But he couldn't restore the future that had been lost. All his life, Gibson would envy the men who had finished what he had only begun, the men who could put after their names the degrees and qualifications he would never possess, and who would find their life's work in fields of which he could only be a spectator. If the trouble had lain no deeper than this, it might not have mattered greatly. But in salvaging his pride by throwing the blame onto Kathleen, he had walked his whole life. She, and through her all women, had become identified with failure and disgrace. Apart from few attachments, which had not been taken very seriously by either partner, Gibson had never fallen in love again. And now he realized that he never would. Knowing the cause of his complaint had helped him not in the least to find a cure. None of these things, of course, need be mentioned to Jimmy. It was sufficient to give the bare facts and to leave Jimmy to guess what he could. One day, perhaps, he might tell him more, but that depended on many things. When Gibson had finished, he was surprised to find how nervously he was waiting for Jimmy's reactions. He felt himself wondering if the boy had read between the lines and apportioned blame where it was due, whether he would be sympathetic, angry, or merely embarrassed. It had suddenly become of the utmost importance to win Jimmy's respect and friendship, more important than anything that had happened to Gibson for a very long time. Only thus could he satisfy his conscience and quieten those accusing voices from the past. He could not see Jimmy's face, for the other was in shadow, and it seemed an age before he broke the silence. "Why have you told me this?" he asked quietly. His voice was completely neutral, free both from sympathy or reproach. Gibson hesitated before answering. The pause was natural enough, for even to himself, he could hardly have explained all his motives. "I just had to tell you," he said earnestly. "I couldn't have been happy until I'd done so. And besides, I felt I might be able to help somehow." Again that nerve-wracking silence. Then Jimmy rose slowly to his feet.
"I'll have to think about what you've told me," he said, his voice still almost emotionless. "I don't know what to say now."
Then he was gone. He left Gibson in a state of extreme uncertainty and confusion, wondering whether he had made a fool of himself or not. Jimmy's self-control, his failure to react, had thrown him off balance and left him completely at a loss. Only of one thing was he certain. In telling the facts, he had already done a great deal to relieve his mind. But there was still much that he had not told Jimmy. Indeed, there was still much that he did not know himself.
Chapter 7. "This is completely crazy," stormed Norden, looking like a berserk Viking chief. "There must be some explanation. Good heavens, there aren't any proper docking facilities on Deimos. How do they expect us to unload? I'm going to call the chief executive and raise hell."
"I shouldn't if I were you," drawled Bradley. "Did you notice the signature? This isn't an instruction from Earth routed through Mars. It originated in the CE's office. The old man may be a Tartar, but he doesn't do things unless he's got a good reason."
"Name just one."
Bradley shrugged his shoulders.
"I don't have to run Mars, so how would I know? We'll find out soon enough."
He gave a malicious little chuckle.
"I wonder how Mackie's going to take it. He'll have to recompute our approach orbit."
Norden leaned across the control panel and threw a switch.
"Hello, Mac. Skipper here. You receiving me?"
There was a short pause, then Hilton's voice came from the speaker.
"Mac's not here at the moment. Any message?"
"All right. You can break it to him. We've had orders from Mars to reroute the ship. They've diverted us from Phobos. No reason given at all. Tell Mac to calculate an orbit to Deimos, and to let me have it as soon as he can."
"I don't understand it. Why, Deimos is just a lot of mountains with no..."
"Yes, we've been through all that. Maybe we'll know the answer when we get there. Tell Mac to contact me as soon as he can, will you?"
Dr. Scott broke the news to Gibson while the author was putting the final touches to one of his weekly articles.
"Heard the latest?" he exclaimed breathlessly. "We've been diverted to Deimos. Skipper's mad as hell. It may make us a day late."
"Does anyone know why?"
"No, it's a complete mystery. We've asked, but Mars won't tell."
Gibson scratched his head, examining and rejecting half a dozen ideas. He knew that Phobos, the inner moon, had been used as a base ever since the first expedition had reached Mars. Only 6,000 kilometers from the surface of the planet, and with a gravity less than 1/1000th of Earth's, it was ideal for this purpose. The Ares was due to dock in less than a week, and already Mars was a small disk showing numerous surface markings even to the naked eye. Gibson had borrowed a large Mercator projection of the planet and had begun to learn the names of its chief features, names that had been given, most of them, more than a century ago by astronomers who had certainly never dreamed that men would one day use them as part of their normal lives. How poetical those old mapmakers had been when they had ransacked mythology. Even to look at those words on the map was to see the blood pounding in the veins. Deucalion, Elysium, Eumenides, Arcadia, Atlantis, Utopia, Eos. Gibson could sit for hours fondling those wonderful names with his tongue, feeling as if in truth Keats' charmed magic casements were opening before him. that there were no seas, perilous or otherwise, on Mars, though many of its lands were sufficiently forlorn. The path of the Ares was now cutting steeply across the planet's orbit, and in a few days the motors would be checking the ship's outward speed. The change of velocity needed to deflect the voyage orbit from Phobos to Deimos was trivial, though it had involved Mackie in several hours of computing. Every meal was devoted to discussing one thing, the crew's plans when Mars was reached. Gibson's could be summed up in one phrase, to see as much as possible. It was, perhaps, a little optimistic to imagine that one could get to know a whole planet in 2 months, despite Bradley's repeated assurances that 2 days was quite long enough for Mars. The excitement of the voyage's approaching end had, to some extent, taken Gibson's mind away from his personal problems. He met Jimmy perhaps half a dozen times a day at meals and during accidental encounters, but they had not reopened their earlier conversation. For a while, Gibson suspected that Jimmy was deliberately avoiding him, but he soon realized that this was not altogether the case. Like the rest of the crew, Jimmy was very busy preparing for the end of the voyage. Norden was determined to have the ship in perfect condition when she docked, and a vast amount of checking and servicing was in progress. Yet despite this activity, Jimmy had given a good deal of thought to what Gibson had told him. At first, he had felt bitter and angry towards the man who had been responsible, however unintentionally, for his mother's unhappiness. But after a while, he began to see Gibson's point of view and understood a little of the other's feelings. Jimmy was shrewd enough to guess that Gibson had not only left a good deal untold, but had put his own case as favorably as possible. Even allowing for this, however, it was obvious that Gibson genuinely regretted the past and was anxious to undo whatever damage he could, even though he was a generation late. It was strange to feel the sensation of returning weight and to hear the distant roar of the motors once again, as the Ares reduced her speed to match the far smaller velocity of Mars. The maneuvering and the final delicate course corrections took more than 24 hours. When it was over, Mars was a dozen times as large as the full moon from Earth, with Phobos and Deimos visible as tiny stars whose movements could be clearly seen after a few minutes of observation. Gibson had never really realized how red the great deserts were, but the simple word, red, conveyed no idea of the variety of color on that slowly expanding disk. Some regions were almost scarlet, others yellow-brown, while perhaps the commonest hue was what could best be described as powdered brick. It was late spring in the southern hemisphere, and the polar cap had dwindled to a few glittering specks of whiteness where the snow still lingered stubbornly on higher ground. The broad belt of vegetation between pole and desert was, for the greater part, a pale bluish-green. But every imaginable shade of color could be found somewhere on that mottled disk. The Ares was swimming into the orbit of Deimos at a relative speed of less than 1,000 kilometers an hour. Ahead of the ship, the tiny moon was already showing a visible disk, and as the hours passed, it grew until, from a few 100 kilometers away, it looked as large as Mars. But what a contrast it presented. Here were no rich reds and greens, only a dark chaos of jumbled rocks, of mountains which jutted up towards the stars at all angles in this world of practically zero gravity. Slowly the cruel rocks slid closer and swept past them, as the Ares cautiously felt her way down towards the radio beacon which Gibson had heard calling days before. Presently he saw, on an almost level area a few kilometers below, the first signs that man had ever visited this barren world. 2 rows of vertical pillars jutted up from the ground, and between them was slung a network of cables. Almost imperceptibly, the Ares sank toward Deimos. The main rockets had long since been silenced, for the small auxiliary jets had no difficulty in handling the ship's effective weight of a few 100 kilograms. It was impossible to tell the moment of contact. Only the sudden silence when the jets were cut off told Gibson that the journey was over, and the Ares was now resting in the cradle that had been prepared for her. He was still, of course, 20,000 kilometers from Mars, and would not actually reach the planet itself for another day in one of the little rockets that was already climbing up to meet them. But as far as the Ares was concerned, the voyage was ended. The tiny cabin that had been his home for so many weeks would soon know him no more. He left the observation deck and hurried up to the control room, which he had deliberately avoided during the last busy hours. It was no longer so easy to move around inside the Ares, for the minute gravitational field of Deimos was just sufficient to upset his instinctive movements, and he had to make a conscious allowance for it. He wondered just what it would be like to experience a real gravitational field again. It was hard to believe that only 3 months ago the idea of having no gravity at all had seemed very strange and unsettling. Yet now he had come to regard it as normal. How adaptable the human body was! The entire crew was sitting round the chart table, looking very smug and self-satisfied.
"You're just in time, Martin," said Norden cheerfully. "We're going to have a little celebration. Go and get your camera and take our pictures while we toast the old crate's health." "Don't drink it all before I come back," warned Gibson, and departed in search of his Leica.
When he re-entered, Dr. Scott was attempting an interesting experiment.
"I'm fed up with squirting my beer out of a bulb," he explained. "I want to pour it properly into a glass now we've got the chance again. Let's see how long it takes."
"It'll be flat before it gets there," warned Mackie. "Let's see. Geez, about half a centimetre a second squared. You're pouring from a height of..."
He retired into a brown study. But the experiment was already in progress. Scott was holding the punctured beer tin about a foot above his glass. And, for the first time in 3 months, the word "above" had some meaning, even if very little. For with incredible slowness, the amber liquid oozed out of the tin so slowly that one might have taken it for syrup. A thin column extended downwards, moving almost imperceptibly at first, but then slowly accelerating. It seemed an age before the glass was reached. Then a great cheer went up as contact was made and the level of the liquid began to creep upwards.
"I calculate it should take 120 seconds to get there," Mackie's voice was heard to announce above the din.
"Then you'd better calculate again," retorted Scott. "That's 2 minutes and it's already there."
"Eh?"
said Mackie, startled, and obviously realizing for the first time that the experiment was over. He rapidly rechecked his calculations and suddenly brightened as discovering a misplaced decimal point.
"Silly of me. I never was any good at mental arithmetic. I meant 12 seconds, of course. And that's the man who got us to Mars," said someone in shocked amazement. "I'm going to walk back."
Nobody seemed inclined to repeat Scott's experiment, which, though interesting, was felt to have little practical value. Very soon large amounts of liquid were being squirted out of bulbs in the normal manner, and the party began to get steadily more cheerful. Dr. Scott recited the whole of that saga of the spaceways, and a prodigious feat of memory it was, which paying passengers seldom encounter and which begins, "It was the spaceship Venus." Gibson followed for some time the adventures of this all-too-appropriately named craft and its ingenious though single-minded crew. Then the atmosphere began to get too close for him, and he left to clear his head. Almost automatically, he made his way back to his favourite viewpoint on the observation deck. He had to anchor himself in it, lest the tiny but persistent pull of Deimos dislodge him. Mars, more than half full and slowly waxing, lay dead ahead. Down there the preparations to greet them would already be underway, and even at this moment the little rockets would be climbing invisibly towards Deimos to ferry them down. 14,000 kilometres below, but still 6,000 kilometres above Mars, Phobos was transiting the unlighted face of the planet, shining brilliantly against its star-eclipsing crescent. Just what was happening on that little moon? Gibson wondered half-heartedly. Oh well, he'd find out soon enough. Meanwhile, he'd polish up his aerography. Let's see. There was the double fork of the Sinus Meridiani. Very convenient that, smack on the equator and in zero longitude, and over to the east, was the Syrtis Major. Working from these two obvious landmarks, he could fill in the finer detail. Margarita Facinus was shown up nicely today, but there was a lot of cloud over Xanth. And, Mr. Gibson? He looked round, startled.
Why, Jimmy, you had enough too.
Jimmy was looking rather hot and flushed, obviously another seeker after fresh air. He wavered a little unsteadily into the observation seat, and for a moment stared silently at Mars as if he'd never seen it before. Then he shook his head disapprovingly.
It's awfully big,
he announced to no one in particular.
It isn't as big as Earth, Gibson protested. And in any case, your criticism's completely meaningless, unless you state what standards you're applying. Just what size do you think Mars should be anyway?
This obviously hadn't occurred to Jimmy, and he pondered it deeply for some time.
I don't know, he said sadly. But it's still too big. Everything's too big.
This conversation was going to get nowhere, Gibson decided. He would have to change the subject.
What are you going to do when you get down to Mars? You've got a couple of months to play with before the Ares goes home.
Well, I suppose I'll wander round Port Lowell and go out and look at the deserts. I'd like to do a bit of exploring if I can manage it.
Gibson thought this quite an interesting idea, but he knew that to explore Mars on any useful scale was not an easy undertaking and required a good deal of equipment, as well as experienced guides. It was hardly likely that Jimmy could attach himself to one of the scientific parties which left the settlements from time to time.
I've an idea, he said. They're supposed to show me everything I want to see. Maybe I can organize some trips out into Hellas or Hesperia, where no one's been yet. Would you like to come? We might meet some Martians.
That, of course, had been the stock joke about Mars ever since the first ships had returned with the disappointing news that there weren't any Martians after all. Quite a number of people still hoped, against all evidence, that there might be intelligent life somewhere in the many unexplored regions of the planet.
Yes, said Jimmy. That would be a great idea. No one can stop me. Anyway, my time's my own as soon as we get to Mars. It says so in the contract.
He spoke this rather belligerently, as if for the information of any superior officers who might be listening, and Gibson thought it wisest to remain silent. The silence lasted for some minutes. Then Jimmy began, very slowly, to drift out of the observation port and to slide down the sloping walls of the ship. Gibson caught him before he had travelled very far and fastened two of the elastic handholds to his clothing, on the principle that Jimmy could sleep here just as comfortably as anywhere else. He was certainly much too tired to carry him to his bunk. Is it true that we only look our true selves when we are asleep? Wondered Gibson. Jimmy seemed very peaceful and contented now that he was completely relaxed, although perhaps the ruby light from the great planet above gave him his appearance of well-being. Gibson hoped it was not an illusion. The fact that Jimmy had at last deliberately sought him out was significant. True, Jimmy was not altogether himself, and he might have forgotten the whole incident by morning. But Gibson did not think so. Jimmy had decided, perhaps not yet consciously, to give him another chance. He was on probation. Gibson awoke the next day with the most infernal din ringing in his ears. It sounded as if the Ares was falling to pieces around him, and he hastily dressed and hurried out into the corridor. The first person he met was Mackie, who didn't stop to explain but shouted after him as he went by.
The rockets are here. The first one's going down in 2 hours. Better hurry. You're supposed to be on it.
Gibson scratched his head a little sheepishly.
Someone ought to have told me, he grumbled.
Then he remembered that someone had, so he'd only himself to blame. He hurried back to his cabin and began to throw his property into suitcases. From time to time, the Ares gave a distinct shudder around him, and he wondered just what was going on. Norden, looking rather harassed, met him at the airlock. Dr. Scott, also dressed for departure, was with him. He was carrying, with extreme care, a bulky metal case.
"Hope you two have a nice trip down," said Norden. "We'll be seeing you in a couple of days when we've got the cargo out. So until then... Oh, I almost forgot. I'm supposed to get you to sign this."
"What is it?" asked Gibson suspiciously. "I never sign anything until my agent's vetted it."
"Read it and see," grinned Norden. "It's quite an historic document."
The parchment which Norden had handed him bore these words: "This is to certify that Martin M. Gibson, author, was the first passenger to travel in the liner Ares, of Earth, on her maiden voyage from Earth to Mars." Then followed the date, and space for the signatures of Gibson and the rest of the crew. Gibson wrote his autograph with a flourish.
"I suppose this will end up in the Museum of Astronautics, when they decide where they're going to build it," he remarked.
"So will the Ares, I expect," said Scott.
"That's a fine thing to say at the end of her first trip," protested Norden. "But I guess you're right. Well, I must be off. The others are outside in their suits. Shout to them as you go across. See you on Mars."
For the second time, Gibson climbed into a spacesuit, now feeling quite a veteran at this sort of thing.
"Of course you'll understand," explained Scott, "that when the service is properly organized, the passengers will go across to the ferry through a connecting tube. That will cut out all this business."
"They'll miss a lot of fun," Gibson replied, as he quickly checked the gauges on the little panel beneath his chin. The outer door opened before them, and they jetted themselves slowly out across the surface of Deimos. The Ares, supported in the cradle of ropes, which must have been hastily prepared within the last week, looked as if a wrecking party had been at work on her. Gibson understood now the cause of the bangings and thumpings that had awakened him. Most of the plating from the southern hemisphere had been removed to get at the hold, and the space-suited members of the crew were bringing out the cargo, which was now being piled on the rocks around the ship. It looked, Gibson thought, a very haphazard sort of operation. He hoped that no one would accidentally give his luggage a push which would send it off irretrievably into space to become a third and still tinier satellite of Mars. Lying 50 meters from the Ares and quite dwarfed by her bulk were the two winged rockets that had come up from Mars during the night. One was already having cargo ferried into it. The other, a much smaller vessel, was obviously intended for passengers only. As Gibson slowly and cautiously followed Scott towards it, he switched over to the general wavelength of his suit and called goodbye to his crewmates. Their envious replies came back promptly, interspersed with much puffing and blowing, for the loads they were shifting, though practically weightless, possessed their normal inertia, and so were just as hard to set moving as on Earth.
"That's right," came Bradley's voice. "Leave us to do all the work." "You've won compensation," laughed Gibson. "You must be the highest paid stevedores in the solar system."
He could sympathize with Bradley's point of view. This was not the sort of work for which the highly trained technicians of the Ares had signed on. But the mysterious diversion of the ship from the tiny, though well-equipped port on Phobos had made such improvisations unavoidable. One couldn't very well make individual goodbyes on open circuit, with half a dozen people listening, and in any case, Gibson would be seeing everyone again in a few days. He would like to have had an extra word with Jimmy, but that would have to wait. It was quite an experience seeing a new human face again. The rocket pilot came into the airlock to help them with their suits, which were gently deposited back on Deimos for future use, simply by opening the outer door again and letting the air current do the rest. Then he led them into the tiny cabin and told them to relax in the padded seats.
"Since you've had no gravity for a couple of months," he said, "I'm taking you down as gently as I can. I won't use more than a normal Earth gravity, but even that may make you feel as if you weigh a ton. Ready?"
"Yes," said Gibson, trying valiantly to forget his last experience of this nature. There was a gentle, faraway roar, and something thrust him firmly down into the depths of his seat. The crags and mountains of Deimos sank swiftly behind. He caught a last glimpse of the Ares, a bright silver dumbbell against that nightmare jumble of rocks. Only a second's burst of power had liberated them from the tiny moon. They were now floating round Mars in a free orbit. For several minutes, the pilot studied his instruments, receiving radio checks from the planet beneath and swinging the ship round its gyros. Then he punched the firing key again, and the rockets thundered for a few seconds more. The ship had broken free from the orbit of Deimos and was falling towards Mars. The whole operation was an exact replica, in miniature, of a true interplanetary voyage. Only the times and durations were changed. It would take them 3 hours, not months, to reach their goal, and they had only thousands instead of millions of kilometers to travel. "Well," said the pilot, locking his controls and swinging round in his seat. "Had a good trip?"
"Quite pleasant, thanks," said Gibson. "Not much excitement, of course. Everything went very smoothly."
"How's Mars these days?" asked Scott.
"Oh, just the same as usual. All work and not much play. The big thing at the moment is the new dome we're building at Lowell. 300 meters clear span. You'll be able to think you're back on Earth. We're wondering if we can arrange clouds and rain inside it."
"What's all this Phobos business?" said Gibson with a nose for news.
"It caused us a lot of trouble." "Oh, I don't think it's anything important. No one seems to know exactly. But there are quite a lot of people up there building a big lab. My guess is that Phobos is going to be a pure research station, and they don't want liners coming and going and messing up their instruments with just about every form of radiation known to science."
Gibson felt disappointed at the collapse of several interesting theories. Perhaps if he had not been so intent on the approaching planet, he might have considered this explanation a little more critically. But for the moment it satisfied him, and he gave the matter no further thought. When Mars seemed in no great hurry to come closer, Gibson decided to learn all he could about the practical details of life on the planet, now that he had a genuine colonist to question. He had a morbid fear of making a fool of himself, either by ignorance or tactlessness, and for the next couple of hours the pilot was kept busy alternating between Gibson and his instruments. Mars was less than 1,000 kilometers away when Gibson released his victim and devoted his whole attention to the expanding landscape beneath. They were passing swiftly over the equator, coming down into the outer fringes of the planet's extremely deep yet very tenuous atmosphere. Presently, and it was impossible to tell when the moment arrived, Mars ceased to be a planet floating in space and became instead a landscape far below. Deserts and oases fled beneath. The Syrtis Major came and passed before Gibson had time to recognize it. They were 50 kilometers up when there came the first hint that the air was thickening around them. A faint and distant sighing, seeming to come from nowhere, began to fill the cabin. The thin air was tugging at their hurtling projectile with feeble fingers, but its strength would grow swiftly. Too swiftly, if their navigation had been at fault. Gibson could feel the deceleration mounting as the ship slackened its speed. The whistle of air was now so loud, even through the insulation of the walls, that normal speech would have been difficult. This seemed to last for a very long time, though it could only have been a few minutes. At last, the wail of the wind died slowly away. The rocket had shed all its surplus speed against air resistance. The refractory material of its nose and knife-edged wings would be swiftly cooling from cherry red. No longer a spaceship now, but simply a high-speed glider, the little ship was racing across the desert at less than 1,000 kilometers an hour, riding down the radio beam into Port Lowell. Gibson first glimpsed the settlement as a tiny white patch on the horizon, against the dark background of the Aurorae Cygnus. The pilot swung the ship round in a great whistling arc to the south, losing altitude and shedding his surplus speed. As the rocket banked, Gibson had a momentary picture of half a dozen large circular domes clustered closely together. Then the ground was rushing up to meet him. There was a series of gentle bumps, and the machine rolled slowly to a standstill. He was on Mars. He had reached what to ancient man had been a moving red light among the stars, what to the men of only a century ago had been a mysterious and utterly unattainable world, and what was now the frontier of the human race.
"There's quite a reception committee," remarked the pilot. "All the transport fleets come out to see us. I didn't know they had so many vehicles serviceable."
Two small squat machines with very wide balloon tires had come racing up to meet them. Each had a pressurized driving cab large enough to hold two people, but a dozen passengers had managed to crowd onto the little vehicles by grabbing convenient handholds. Behind them came two large half-tracked buses, also full of spectators. Gibson had not expected quite such a crowd and began to compose a short speech.
"I don't suppose you know how to use these things yet," said the pilot, producing two breathing masks. "But you've only got to wear them for a minute while you get over to the fleas."
The what? Thought Gibson. Oh, of course, those little vehicles would be the famous Martian sand fleas, the planet's universal transports.
"I'll fix them on for you. Oxygen. Okay. Right, here we go. It may feel a bit queer at first."
The air slowly hissed from the cabin until the pressure inside and out had been equalized. Gibson felt his exposed skin tingling uncomfortably. The atmosphere around him was now thinner than above the peak of Everest. It had taken 3 months of slow acclimatization on the Ares and all the resources of modern medical science to enable him to step out onto the surface of Mars with no more protection than a simple oxygen mask. It was flattering that so many people had come to meet him. Of course, it wasn't often that Mars could expect so distinguished a visitor, but he knew that the busy little colony had no time for ceremonial. Dr. Scott emerged beside him, still carrying the large metal case he had nursed so carefully through the whole of the trip. At his appearance, a group of the colonists came rushing forward, completely ignored Gibson, and crowded round Scott. Gibson could hear their voices, so distorted in this thin air as to be almost incomprehensible.
"Glad to see you again, Doc. Here, let us carry it."
"We've got everything ready, and there are 10 cases waiting in hospital now. We should know how good it is in a week.
Come on, get into the bus and talk later."
Before Gibson had realized what was happening, Scott and his impediments had been swept away. There was a shrill whine of a powerful motor, and the bus tore off towards Port Lowell, leaving Gibson feeling as foolish as he had ever been in his life. He had completely forgotten the serum. To Mars, its arrival was of infinitely greater importance than a visit by any novelist, however distinguished he might be on his own planet. It was a lesson he would not forget in a hurry. Luckily, he had not been completely deserted. The sand fleas were still left. One of the passengers disembarked and hurried up to him.
"Mr. Gibson? I'm Westerman of the Times, the Martian Times, that is. Very pleased to meet you. This is..."
"Henderson, in charge of port facilities,"
interrupted a tall, hatchet-faced man, obviously annoyed that the other had got in first.
"I've seen that your luggage will be collected. Jump aboard."
It was quite obvious that Westerman would have much preferred Gibson as his own passenger, but he was forced to submit with as good grace as he could manage. Gibson climbed into Henderson's flea through the flexible plastic bag that was the vehicle's simple but effective airlock, and the other joined him a minute later in the driving cab. It was a relief to discard the breathing mask. The few minutes he had spent in the open had been quite a strain. He also felt very heavy and sluggish, the exact reverse of the sensation one would have expected on reaching Mars. But for 3 months, he had known no gravity at all, and it would take him some time to grow accustomed to even a third of his terrestrial weight. The vehicle began to race across the landing strip, towards the domes of the port, a couple of kilometers away. For the first time, Gibson noticed that all around him was the brilliant mottled green of the hardy plants that were the commonest life form on Mars. Overhead, the sky was no longer jet black, but a deep and glorious blue. The sun was not far from the zenith, and its rays struck with surprising warmth through the plastic dome of the cabin. Gibson peered at the dark vault of the sky, trying to locate the tiny moon on which his companions were still at work. Henderson noticed his gaze, took one hand off the steering wheel, and pointed close to the sun.
There she is,
he said. Gibson shielded his eyes and stared into the sky. Then he saw, hanging like a distant electric arc against the blue, a brilliant star a little westwards of the sun. It was far too small, even for Deimos, but it was a moment before Gibson realized that his companion had mistaken the object of his search. That steady, unwinking light, burning so unexpectedly in the daylight sky, was now, and would remain for many weeks, the morning star of Mars. But it was better known as Earth. Chapter 8
Sorry to have kept you waiting, said Mayor Whittaker. But you know the way it is. The chief's been in conference for the last hour. I've only just been able to get hold of him myself to tell him you're here. This way. We'll take the shortcut through records. It might have been an ordinary office on Earth. The door said simply enough, Chief Executive. There was no name. It wasn't necessary. Everyone in the solar system knew who ran Mars. Indeed, it was difficult to think of the planet without thinking of Warren Hadfield at the same time. Gibson was surprised when he rose from his desk to see that the chief executive was a good deal shorter than he had imagined. He must have judged the man by his works and had never guessed that he could give him a couple of inches in height. But the thin, wiry frame and sensitive, rather bird-like head were exactly as he had expected. The interview began with Gibson somewhat on the defensive, for so much depended on his making a good impression. His way would be infinitely easier if he had the chief on his side. In fact, if he made an enemy of Hadfield, he might just as well go home right away.
I hope Whittaker's been looking after you,
said the chief when the initial courtesies had been exchanged.
You'll realize that I couldn't see you before. I've only just got back from an inspection. How are you settling down here?
Quite well, smiled Gibson. I'm afraid I've broken a few things by leaving them in mid-air, but I'm getting used to living with gravity again.
And what do you think of our little city?
It's a remarkable achievement. I don't know how you managed to do so much in the time. Hadfield was eyeing him narrowly.
Be perfectly frank. It's smaller than you expected, isn't it?
Gibson hesitated.
Well, I suppose it is. But then I'm used to the standards of London and New York. After all, 2,000 people would only make a large village back on Earth. Such a lot of Port Lowell's underground, too, and that makes a difference.
The chief executive seemed neither annoyed nor surprised.
Everyone has a disappointment when they see Mars' largest city, he said. Still, it's going to be a lot bigger in another week when the new dome goes up. Tell me, just what are your plans now you've got here? I suppose you know I wasn't very much in favor of this visit in the first place.
I gathered that on Earth, said Gibson, a little taken aback. He had yet to discover that frankness was one of the chief executive's major virtues. It was not one that endeared him to many people.
I suppose you were afraid I'd get in the way.
Yes, but now you're here, we'll do the best for you.
I hope you'll do the same for us.
In what way? Asked Gibson, stiffening defensively. Hadfield leaned across the table and clasped his hands together with an almost feverish intensity.
We're at war, Mr. Gibson. We're at war with Mars and all the forces it can bring against us. Cold, lack of water, lack of air. And we're at war with Earth. It's a paper war, true, but it's got its victories and defeats. I'm fighting a campaign at the end of a supply line that's never less than 50 million kilometers long. The most urgent goods take at least 5 months to reach me, and I only get them if Earth decides I can't manage any other way. I suppose you realize what I'm fighting for. My primary objective, that is. It's self-sufficiency. Remember that the first expeditions had to bring everything with them. Well, we can provide all the basic necessities of life now from our own resources. Our workshops can make almost anything that isn't too complicated, but it's all a question of manpower. There are some very specialized goods that simply have to be made on Earth,
and until our population's at least 10 times as big, we can't do much about it. Everyone on Mars is an expert at something. But there are more skilled trades back on Earth than there are people on this planet, and it's no use arguing with arithmetic. You see those graphs over there? I started keeping them 5 years ago. They show our production index for various key materials. We've reached the self-sufficiency level, that horizontal red line, for about half of them. I hope that in another 5 years there will be very few things we'll have to import from Earth. Even now, our greatest need is manpower, and that's where you may be able to help us. Gibson looked a little uncomfortable. I can't make any promises. Please remember that I'm here purely as a reporter. Emotionally, I'm on your side, but I've got to describe the facts as I see them. I appreciate that, but facts aren't everything. What I hope you'll explain to Earth is the things we hope to do, just as much as the things we've done. They're even more important, but we can achieve them only if Earth gives us its support. Not all your predecessors have realized that. That was perfectly true, thought Gibson. He remembered a critical series of articles in the Daily Telegraph about a year before. The facts had been quite accurate, but a similar account of the first settlers' achievements after 5 years' colonization of North America would probably have been just as discouraging. I think I can see both sides of the question, said Gibson. You've got to realize that from the point of view of Earth, Mars is a long way away, costs a lot of money and doesn't offer anything in return. The first glamour of interplanetary exploration has worn off. Now people are asking, what do we get out of it? So far the answer's been very little. I'm convinced that your work is important, but in my case, it's an act of faith rather than a matter of logic. The average man back on Earth probably thinks the millions you're spending here could be better used improving his own planet. When he thinks of it at all, that is. I understand your difficulty. It's a common one, and it isn't easy to answer. Let me put it this way. I suppose most intelligent people would admit the value of a scientific base on Mars, devoted to pure research and investigation? Undoubtedly. But they can't see the purpose of building up a self-contained culture, which may eventually become an independent civilization? That's the trouble, precisely. They don't believe it's possible or, granted the possibility, don't think it's worthwhile. You'll often see articles pointing out that Mars will always be a drag on the home planet because of the tremendous natural difficulties under which you're laboring. What about the analogy between Mars and the American colonies? It can't be pressed too far. After all, men could breathe the air and find food to eat when they got to America. That's true. But though the problem of colonizing Mars is so much more difficult, we've got enormously greater powers at our control. Given time and material, we can make this a world as good to live on as Earth. Even now, you won't find many of our people who want to go back. They know the importance of what they're doing. Earth may not need Mars yet, but one day it will. I wish I could believe that, said Gibson a little unhappily. He pointed to the rich green tide of vegetation that lapped like a hungry sea against the almost invisible dome of the city, at the great plain that hurried so swiftly over the edge of the curiously close horizon, and at the scarlet hills within whose arms the city lay. Mars is an interesting world, even a beautiful one. But it can never be like Earth. Why should it be? And what do you mean by Earth, anyway? Do you mean the South American pampas, the vineyards of France, the coral islands of the Pacific, the Siberian steppes? Earth is every one of those. Wherever men can live, that will be home to someone someday. And sooner or later, men will be able to live on Mars without all this. He waved towards the dome which floated above the city and gave it life. Do you really think, protested Gibson, that men can ever adapt themselves to the atmosphere outside? They won't be men any longer if they do. For a moment, the chief executive did not reply. Then he remarked quietly,
I said nothing about men adapting themselves to Mars. Have you ever considered the possibility of Mars meeting us halfway?